Greetings, and welcome to Bear Soup. News, interviews, skews, and schmooze for the online Ursine community. I am your host, Ron Suresha. Up ahead in this 85th episode of Bear Soup, the return of the walrus mustache, facial hair in politics, and the latest hairy business from the Kinsey Six. First, we have a selection from another new book, just out from the Bookish Bears at Bare Bones Books. The following piece, How to Be a Country Leather Bear, written by Jeff Mann, is from his new book, Binding the God, Ursine Essays from the Mountain South. Everyone thinks of us as a city species, we leather bears, but you know better, you small-town gay men sporting beards, body hair, and brawn. You country-dwelling devotees of BDSM and rough man-on-man sex. Perhaps you live in a rural area because you grew up there to begin with and had little desire to leave, even after you realized you were queer. Perhaps you stayed in or near your hometown to be close to family or friends. Perhaps you left the city for financial reasons, to take advantage of the lower cost of living in the provinces. Perhaps you once tasted city life and recoiled, decided that living the urban gay lifestyle wasn't worth the noise and traffic, the crowds and expense, and so returned to your roots, determined to stay. Whatever the reasons for your rustic existence, know that being a country leather bear is easier than the city-loving twink might imagine. Yes, country folks tend more toward homophobia and conservatism than frequently liberal urbanites. Most small towns sport churches on every other corner, crammed on Sundays with frothing fundamentalists, convinced that men-loving men are satanic monsters. But you, as a leather bear, are likely to deal with such unfriendly surroundings better than many of your queer brethren. There are two reasons for this. One, the outfits of the typical leather bear are identical to those of most straight country boys. In winter, both kinds of men wear work boots, cowboy boots, thermal undershirts, sweatshirts, faded jeans, leather jackets, denim jackets, and cowboy hats. In summer, they sport baseball caps, cargo shorts, camo pants, A-shirts, muscle shirts, tank tops, and T-shirts. The proof of this is Larry the Cable Guy, the blue-collar comedian. Step into any bear bar, and 4 out of every 5 men there will resemble him. Thus, if you choose not to be openly gay, you're well camouflaged. If you wear the typical leather bear ensemble, you'll look like any other redneck and will more easily be able to go about your life without having to tolerate public harassment, as many of our more effeminate compatriots must. Here's the downside. If you, like many bears, are attracted to men who look like you, you're often going to be seething with frustrated lust, surrounded by all those sexy straight men who look like leather bears but aren't. The second reason why living around rural conservatives is easier for leather bears is purely physical. We're not young, slender boys, weak from constant dieting. We're big, bulk being part of the definition of being a bear, and our furry faces and bodies make us look manly and menacing. The intolerant are simply less likely to pick a fight with men like us. Hit the gym, buddy. Work some heft into your chest and arms. Sport a few intimidating butch tattoos. While you're at it, boxing and the martial arts are fine hobbies to adopt. This protective coloration said and done, I'd recommend that you come out to as many of your neighbors as possible, unless they're obviously pious swine, gun collectors, or twice your size. People need to know that queers are all around them and that we come in many sizes and shapes. Diffusing ignorance diffuses hatred. So, made relatively safe by your brawn and your apparent similarity to other rural men, what you must figure out is how to lead a fulfilling life so far from queer central. Since you live in the countryside or a small town, spend some time exploring what pleasures these settings provide. Visit the local restaurant, doing your best to ignore the Jesus paraphernalia on the wall, and take advantage of down-home cooking at low prices that would cause city folk to faint with disbelief. Respond in kind to the server's small-town friendliness and good country manners. Order sausage, biscuits, grits, soup beans, chicken and dumplings, sweet iced tea, coconut cream pie. Attend seasonal celebrations that occur annually in your neck of the woods. The country fair, the maple syrup festival, railroad days. For God's sake, get outdoors as often as possible. Take advantage of the natural world that city and suburban dwellers rarely get to appreciate, save on vacation. Hike up to Dragon's Tooth Knob, bike the new river trail, walk along Claytor Lake. On weekends, visit nearby state parks and national forests. Keep an eye out for hawks, butterflies, muskrats, white-tailed deer. Luxuriate in the silence, the dark country nights that city folks are denied. If you have the land, grow a garden. Pick fresh tomatoes, peppers, corn, basil, oregano, mint. Many urban queers hanker after occasional escapes from metropolitan ruckus. Fulfilling this need is a fine way to enjoy small-town living and queer companionship at the same time. All you need is a guest room and a talent for cooking. Learn to mix drinks, make pasta, cook up stews, bake biscuits and pies. You're a bear, after all. You love to eat and drink. Your gay and lesbian friends, eager for a change of pace from D.C., San Francisco, and New York City, will be grateful for a weekend in the country. Quiet evenings by the fireplace, playing some guitar, sipping some bourbon, savoring some chili and cornbread, watching Sordid Lives, Gladiator, 300, or The Birdcage for the 10th time. Country living's easier if you're resourceful and self-reliant, if you savor solitude and learn to take pleasure in small things. The shifting seasons, the changes in weather, big meals, good books, music, and movies. The frost on the window pane resembles feathers. There's a new cheese at the local food city. A new variety of scotch at the liquor store. Joni Mitchell just released a new CD. The latest Netflix DVD has Viggo Mortensen naked. The sexually goateed FedEx man just delivered, unbeknownst to him, porn star Francois Sagat, bound and gagged in the latest Titan video release, Fear. Come to terms with country masculinity. Winnow it, take the best, and throw away the rest. Many of us, once we discovered our homosexuality, rejected traditional masculine activities, the ones so beloved of small-town folks dedicated to old-fashioned gender roles. Look again. You can be brave and nurturing, strong and tender. Many apparently mutually exclusively things are really not. Honor, loyalty, stoicism, and protectiveness are warrior virtues more than worth retaining. As besieged as the queer community is these days, we need all the warriors, male and female, we can get. Many of us, influenced by media and the prevailing urban values of the queer community, tend to hold country enthusiasms in contempt. Look again. Pickup trucks are handy as hell, and damned handsome at that. Whether live or televised, basketball, football, and baseball games can be pretty pleasurable. The players are often sexy, the beer and hot dogs cheap and tasty. Country music brims with top-notch guitar playing and heartfelt lyrics. Along with Reba McEntire, Dolly Parton, and other country divas so adored by drag queens, there's a passel of fuckable and furry studs who apotheosize the concept of sexy country boy. Prominent among them, lean and luscious Tim McGraw, hunky goateed Chris Cagle, burly blonde bear Toby Keith, and adorable cublet Chris Young, all ripe subjects for kidnapping fantasies and fodder for erotic fiction. In other words, you don't need to be the sleek, smooth, slender, well-groomed, androgynous, and thoroughly domesticated city queer of many an Advocate ad or TLA movie. You can preserve a little wildness, like the rural landscape around you. You can be as beefy and scruffy as many a country boy and still be thoroughly queer. Adding gay, erotic elements to a country life can be challenging, but between the internet and an active imagination, you can work wonders. Try to picture what being a country queer of any stripe was like before web browsing. It was an isolation that bred soul-killing loneliness, despair, and suicidal thoughts. Now a few minutes on Firefox can net you a slew of distant delights. Order BDSM gear, bondage tape, handcuffs, ball gags, hoods, tit clamps, and other toys beloved of leather bears from faraway stores like Mr. S. or JT's Stockroom. Buy erotic bondage art from countries as remote as Japan. Check out the amazing work of Gengora Tagame for evocative, arousing images of muscle bears bound, gagged, tortured, and raped. If you're single or in an open relationship, hunt down partners for long-distance flirtation. If you're lucky, you might even lure one into visiting. Now back to that guest bedroom and that cookbook collection. There are lots of city pent leather boys likely to relish a cozy weekend in your B&B, bound to your bed or treated to your home cooking. If you affix a leather or bear flag sticker to the back window of your pickup truck, you might meet friends or playmates even closer to home. A note with a stranger's phone number or email address might be waiting for you beneath your windshield wiper when you're done fetching groceries and cruising the sexy young clerk at Food City. And being out to your neighbors is likely to net you advice regarding the location of local queers. Sociable, small-town folks are often eager to introduce people with similar interests. It takes imagination to infuse daily life, which tends toward the habitual, the boring, and the mundane, with erotic energy, whether you're partnered or single. It's even harder in the queer, sparse countryside, but if achieved, it adds an edge and intensity that we leather bears cherish. Wear that chain and padlock slave collar beneath your sweater when you go to work, or the naughty, butch bear, hairy, horny, hungry t-shirt that you bought online. Slip in a butt plug for your workout at the local YMCA. Take pleasure in the weight of a chrome donut cock ring while attending the baseball game. Handcuff and bit gag your partner before cuddling on the couch to watch the latest Netflix. Leave him hogtied and ball-gagged on the floor of the closet for an hour on Sunday morning while the rest of the county sings hymns in church. Half of the pleasure of being a kink buff living in a rural or conservative area is knowing how much you're getting away with and picturing the expressions on your neighbors' faces if they only knew. Finally, save the money and take the time to travel, whether it's to the nearest small city for a bear or leather run, to San Francisco to check out the infamous bear bar, the Lone Star, to D.C. to admire all the bear and hairy torsos during Green Lantern's shirtless night, to Key West for the clothing-optional all-male guest houses, or overseas to explore the leather bars of Vienna, London, and Berlin. Novelty is exhilarating. You'll see what you're missing. You'll admire the plethora of sexy city men. If you're lucky, you'll bind, gag, and bed a few. You'll ravish a few restaurants, too. Then you'll be ready to go home, where there are still trees and pastures, where things are slow enough for folk culture, tradition, and good manners to survive, where the nights are very dark and you can see the stars. And in the Bear Soup, ongoing coverage of facial hair in politics. There are two articles that came out before the election that I wanted to share with you, one of which quotes our friend Alan Peterkin. The first one, Read My Furry Lip, is from the Wall Street Journal by Ruth Graham. The United States has not had a president with facial hair since a clean-shaven Woodrow Wilson won the election of 1912 and replaced the mustachioed William Howard Taft. Enter former United States Ambassador John Bolton, who hinted he may run for office in 2012. Is America ready for its first hairy-lipped commander-in-chief in a century? Mustaches have experienced a pop cultural renaissance in recent years. Brad Pitt, Sean Penn, and Matt Damon have sported them on the red carpet. Mustachioed models have walked the runway at fashion shows by Jean-Paul Gaultier and Yunya Watanabe. In Washington and on Wall Street, however, it's a different story. According to Alan Peterkin, the author of 1,000 Beards, A Cultural History of Facial Hair, whiskers are taboo in arenas in which faddishness is frowned on and the appearance of transparency is prized. Quote, facial hair is the kiss of death in politics, Mr. Peterkin said. There are mustache clubs, mustache contests, and mustache parties. In some corners of Brooklyn, it's as common an accessory as dark frame glasses and an iPhone. In Washington and on Wall Street, however, it's a different story. According to Alan Peterkin, the author of 1,000 Beards, A Cultural History of Facial Hair, whiskers are taboo in arenas in which faddishness is frowned on and the appearance of transparency is prized. Facial hair is the kiss of death in politics, Mr. Peterkin said. The generalization I'd make about modern facial hair is its playful rebellion. And do you want a politician who's into playful rebellion? Roland Burris, Democrat of Illinois, is the only one of 100 senators to sport a mustache, and he's an unelected appointee who will step down in January. the list of House members with facial hair is somewhat longer. A geographically diverse 41 by this reporter's count, including Henry Waxman, Democrat of California, David Obey, Democrat of Wisconsin, and Charles Rangel, Democrat of New York. Last year, New York Governor David Paterson shaved a short-lived beard into a short-lived mustache. But the modern presidential face has remained staunchly bare, and given the long odds against Mr. Bolton, he's unlikely to change that. Mustachioed Republican Thomas Dewey lost the presidential elections of 1944 and 1948, when a photo of President Obama last year suggested he might have had a day-old growth on his upper lip. The sparse shadow made headlines and quickly disappeared. Facial hair in the White House hasn't always seemed so silly. Presidents Abraham Lincoln, Ulysses S. Grant, Rutherford Hayes, James Garfield, and Benjamin Harrison all wore full beards. Presidents Martin Van Buren and Chester Arthur sported wild sideburns. Presidents Grover Cleveland, Theodore Roosevelt, and William Taft wore bushy mustaches. For most of human history, facial hairstyles have been constrained as much by the inconvenience of shaving as by fads. That changed when King Camp Gillette debuted his disposable razor blade in 1903. By 1906, W.G. Schocke patented a wind-up safety razor, forebearer to the electric razor now used by about 20% of male shavers. A new industry arose to convince Americans that a clean face was next to godliness, and a concurrent hygiene movement disparaged facial hair as unsanitary. When the U.S. entered World War I, the government ordered 3.5 million razors and 36 million blades for its soldiers. The mustache remains popular abroad, especially in the Middle East and in Southeast Asia. But in American minds, the most prominent 20th century mustache wearers here are Hitler, Stalin, and Saddam Hussein. The mustache now signifies villainy, combined with a 1970s swinger bisexual porn star association, as Mr. Peterkin put it. It's those connotations that experts believe is holding the mustache back. Beards fare somewhat better as the style of the intellectual, the hippie, or the revolutionary. Unfortunately for Mr. Bolton, a Republican, those are widely considered Democratic traits. First impressions matter in politics, especially in the early stages of a campaign. Gabriel Lentz, a political science professor at MIT who has studied the effect of candidate appearance on voter behavior, said, "When voters don't know much about a person, they use their faces to judge them. So is a prospective candidate with a slightly off-kilter appearance better off altering or embracing it?" Maxine Albert, a New York-based image consultant who has worked with politicians, said it's better to rip off the Band-Aid, so to speak. "I'd advise Mr. Bolton to get rid of it," she said. "The mustache puts something between him and the audience." But Michael Lewis, a professor at Emory University's Business School who has studied political campaigns from a marketing perspective, urged caution. "For a Republican, the ideal positioning space is to be the rugged outdoorsman, like Reagan, with a horse and boots and hat," he said. "A trip to the beauty parlor doesn't really fit in." Jay Della Valle, the 31-year-old chairman of the American Mustache Institute and director of a documentary about the hipster mustache trend, agrees. "John Bolton wouldn't even be John Bolton without his mustache," he said. "It's his secret weapon." That may be. Mr. Peterkin, the beard historian, who is Canadian and wasn't familiar with Mr. Bolton's appearance, had only complimentary things to say after first viewing his photo. "It's a nice one. There's a bit of Mark Twain," he said. "Voters may hearken back to Taft and other Americans who had fine mustaches and beards. There's something classical about it." That's good news for Mr. Bolton, who said he grew his mustache 40 years ago and is sticking with it. "I've never shaved it off," he said, "and I don't intend to." And the following article from Mother Jones magazine from Nick Bauman on October 15th, entitled "Beard vs. Stash, the Real Alaska Senate Face-Off." Quote, "I am not now, nor have I ever been, anything but a clean-shaven capitalist," Chris Coons, Delaware's Democratic Senate candidate, assured voters in a debate against Tea Party Republican Christine O'Donnell Wednesday night. This was an odd remark, but one he felt compelled to make after O'Donnell tried to exploit an article he wrote in college, jokingly describing himself as a bearded Marxist. The intersection of beards and mustaches and politics appears to be quite a hairy issue. A recent Wall Street Journal article on the presidential prospects of former Bush administration official John Bolton, which I just read to you, zeroed in on the impact his walrus-like mustache might have on his chances. But the facial hairiest race of them all is in Alaska, where Tea Partier and GOP nominee Joe Miller is locked in a three-way race with incumbent Republican Lisa Murkowski, who's running a write-in campaign, and Sitka Mayor Scott McAdams, the Democratic nominee. If elected, Miller would be the only U.S. senator with a beard. Miller's beard would also become the only senatorial beard with its own Twitter account. McAdams, who sports a mustache, would join North Dakota GOP candidate John Hoeven, who's favored to win, as the only mustachioed senators. Miller and McAdams' prospects have thrilled beard and mustache boosters. Phil Olson is captain of Beard Team USA, the group that organizes the National Beard and Mustache Championships and fields America's team in the World Beard and Mustache Championships. Olson says that while his organization is officially neutral on both candidacies, they are happy to see those two doing the patriotic thing by growing facial hair for America. The current lack of facial hair in Washington is one of America's greatest problems in need of an urgent solution, Olson adds. He says he would urge both candidates to commit to keeping their facial hair in Washington. McAdams and Miller's campaigns did not respond to requests for comment. Dr. Aaron Perlett, the chairman of the American Mustache Institute, sent a response to Mother Jones's request for comment. Quote, Comrade McAdams's addition to the currently underwhelming lot of mustached American congressmen and senators would be welcome, serving as a sterling notice to youngsters who aspire to great heights that people of mustached American descent indeed have a place at the table. Certainly, the mustached American community of Alaska and the voting Russians in plain view outside of Sarah Palin's back door would support Comrade McAdams and go to great lengths to propagate his candidacy and values. There is one mustached American currently serving in the Senate, Roland Burris, whom former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich appointed to fill Barack Obama's vacated Senate seat. But Burris is not running for re-election, so if Murkowski wins her write-in bid and Hoeven somehow loses, the upper house of Congress will be completely devoid of facial hair. In the House, only a few dozen of the 435 members have facial hair. The most powerful, Henry Waxman, the chair of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, is known on Capitol Hill as the Mustache of Justice. The substantial mustache of Arizona Representative Raul Grijalva, another powerful Democrat, has recently become an issue in his re-election campaign. But Congress is generally pretty clean-shaven, and it's getting more so. On Thursday, retiring Representative Vic Snyder promised to shave his 40-year-old mustache if people donated $50,000 to Joyce Elliott, the Dem who was hoping to replace him in Arkansas's 2nd Congressional District. It wasn't always this way. Even presidents used to have facial hair. In his response, Perlett mourned the days when fine mustached Americans like Teddy Roosevelt and William Howard Taft sat in the Oval Office at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. But Roosevelt and Taft weren't the only ones. John Quincy Adams had killer mutton chops. The most famous bearded president, of course, was Abraham Lincoln, who grew his during his first presidential campaign, supposedly at the request of 11-year-old Grace Bedell. Lincoln launched a presidential trend. The 18th, 19th, and 20th presidents, Ulysses S. Grant, Rutherford Hayes, and James Garfield, all wore full beards. Chester A. Arthur had big sideburns and a huge mustache. Grover Cleveland had a mustache, and Benjamin Harrison had a beard. But no president since Taft, who left office in 1913, has regularly worn facial hair. The last major party presidential candidate with facial hair was Thomas Dewey, the Republican nominee in 1944 and 1948, who rocked a serious stash. That robust mustache became a big political problem for Dewey, but more on that later. Christopher Oldstone Moore, a history professor at Wright State University in Ohio, who has been called the world's foremost beard expert, has written an, as yet unpublished, academic article about the role of facial hair in politics. He's working on a book, too. I asked him to analyze McAdams and Miller's facial hair choices. In American culture, particularly mustaches and beards, have taken on a certain kind of meaning, Oldstone Moore says. They represent a kind of masculinity that's independent and autonomous, but it has negative connotations, lack of sociability and cooperativeness and not being a team player. Those are stereotypes, but people react to stereotypes. Miller's beard, in particular, spoke to Old Stone more. He notes that Miller's background included two fields, the military and law, that are especially hostile to facial hair. That wasn't always the case. Mustaches were a military staple for hundreds of years. After years of working in clean-shaven cultures, growing a beard, particularly one that is, as Old Stone Moore says, scruffy, is a way of sending a message that Miller is his own man. It's a tough guy beard, almost like Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's, an aggressive, tough guy beard, Old Stone Moore adds. Miller is a Tea Party kind of guy, and he's appealing to a certain kind of self-reliant masculinity. While that might not fly in the lower 48, it probably plays well in Alaska, Old Stone Moore says. Alaska is always the exception. It's the place where people, particularly men, are going to want to assert the independent, self-reliant type of masculinity. Dr. Alan Peterkin, the author of 1,000 Beards, A Cultural History of Facial Hair, agrees that a beard might play differently in Alaska, but still thinks it could be a liability. With a beard, there's an idea that a man might be hiding behind his facial hair. There's no downside to being clean-shaven. People can't project negative things onto that. The mustache, Peterkin says, has an even worse reputation. In American culture, mustaches generally lead to one of three associations: fop, foreigner, or fiend. Few politicians want to be any of those. McAdams's mustache is not all that controversial, Old Stone Moore contends. It's a modest mustache, he says, and mustaches are probably more acceptable than beards in general. But even a modest mustache allows McAdams to project a little more assertiveness. There are other factors to consider. McAdams has a background in the fishing industry, where facial hair is common, and mustaches are considered to work better on rounder faces like McAdams. Size matters, too, Old Stone Moore says. A small mustache that is not too small and doesn't look like Hitler's is probably acceptable, he adds, but not for someone in the most prominent position, like President of the United States. That brings us back to Thomas Dewey, the last major presidential candidate with a mustache. There was a lot of discussion of Dewey's mustache, and it became an obstacle for some voters, particularly women, according to Old Stone Moore. Political columnists at the time regularly weighed in on Dewey's choice of lip adornment. One prominent journalist referred to Dewey as a Clark Gable of candidates. But that's not necessarily a very good thing, Old Stone Moore explains. Clark Gable is alluring and seductive, but also dangerous. You don't want someone like that to be in charge of the government, because there's a sense that you really can't trust him. Another writer, Helen Asari, wrote that she had heard dozens of women make the same criticism, that the mustache takes from the seriousness and strength of his face. Moreover, it will not help with the women vote. You see only the mustache. You remember only the mustache. Without it, Governor Dewey would look 1,000,000% more real as the proper man for the White House job he is after. In the New York Times Magazine, Edith Efron wrote that Dewey may be elected to office, but it will be in spite of his manly attributes, not because of them. Check out the links to both of these articles on the Bear Soup website, www.bearsouppodcast.net. And speaking of hairy businessmen, we have this hairy business from the fabulous Kinsey Six with their latest holiday medley. Enjoy and have a great Hanukkah Kwanzaa.
Christ, you're hot.
Do, do,
you know what this time of year, don't just think of your family. Do something special for your best friend. Filleting my dog. Filleting my dog. Filleting my heart. Conquer Spaniard with his greasy rod. I want a swish in your hairy business. I want my knish in your hairy business. Smells like fried fish in your hairy business. At the bottom of your heart. I want a swish in your hairy business. I want my knish in your hairy business. Compelled to fish in your scary business. At the bottom, at the very bottom of your boat.
This has been the 85th edition of Bear Soup with Ron Sarisha. Thanks to the Mermen, and to Joe of Bear Radio, and as always, to my husband, Rocco. And thanks to you for listening to the Bear Soup Podcast. Email me at bearsoup@gmail.com. Look for Bear Soup, Bear Radio, and Bear Bones Books, also on Facebook. Bubbles for the Bear Soup Hot Tub are powered by our sponsor, Bear Bones Books. Check out their fine titles by bear authors, fiction and nonfiction, for every bear on your holiday list. Just click on the Bear Bones Books link from our homepage at bearsouppodcast.net. Bear Soup is produced for the Bear Radio Network, which is not responsible for the content of this podcast. Remember, sometimes you eat the bear, sometimes the bear eats you.